Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, discoveries are challenging what we learned in our biology class about what makes us male or female. Then, what is the celebrity industrial complex, and how does it impact our democracy, our culture, and our society? Textbook biology teaches us about how our X and Y chromosomes determine our sex, but scientists say it's more complicated than previously understood. Melissa Wilson-Sayers joins us. She is a fellow at the Center for Theoretical Evolutionary Genomics at the University of California, Berkeley. Jeremy Nathans also joins us. He is a research investigator at Howard Hughes Medical Institute and professor of molecular biology and genetics, neuroscience and ophthalmology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome, Jeremy Nathans, and welcome, Melissa Wilson-Sayers. Great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. Both of your studies looked like it was turning a little bit of textbook biology on its head, this idea that our X chromosome and Y chromosomes come together in the case of the female as a double X and as the male with the XY. It seems like there's a little more complication than what we previously understood. How have we understood the function of these two chromosomes before now? Jeremy Nathans, why don't you start?
Well, in all mammals, including people, the sex of a child is determined by which chromosomes he or she inherits from their parents. If a child receives one X chromosome from the mother and one X from the father, she'll be a girl. If a child receives one X from the mother and a Y chromosome from the father, he'll be a boy. And that has been known for a long time, but the interesting recent work explores the structure of the chromosomes and also the way in which their genes are activated or inactivated in patterns in each of us.
Some of what you have found is that this X chromosome is a little bit more mysterious because of the way it chooses activation or inactivation. Can you walk us through some of this?
The original discovery was made around 1960. Mary Lyon, a British mouse geneticist, was the person who put all the pieces together and came up with this most striking hypothesis, which turns out to be right, that in every cell in every female mammal, one of the two X's is chosen to be inactive and the other is chosen to be active. And that means that each female is a mosaic. There is a mixture of cells, some expressing the mother's X chromosome and others expressing the father's X chromosome. And that mechanism has very interesting medical and biological implications. For example, if a woman is carrying one mutant gene on one of her two X chromosomes, then effectively half of her cells on average will be completely mutant and the other half will be completely normal. That's quite different from the case when a gene is on a so-called autosome, one of the standard chromosomes, in which case one gene from the mother and one gene from the father are present, and if one of them is mutated, the other one generally fills in, and although perhaps there will be only half as much of the resulting gene product produced, it's usually enough to keep the cell going. So it creates in females the possibility for variation from one cell to another, one place in the body to another, or one tissue to another.
Which is not present in males.
Yes. So females have an extra level of genetic complexity. I think this certainly resonates with our recollections of junior high school when the boys were, as you probably recall, rather simplistic in their social interactions and the girls were very sophisticated. At least it seemed to me that way.
One of the things that you had said was it could be that one side of the brain is completely dominated by one parent, while the other is the other parent.
To give a little bit of background of our recent work, we've asked in laboratory mice exactly which cells express the mother's X chromosome and which ones express the father's X chromosome. And this was possible because genetic engineering methods allow one to insert genes that encode fluorescent proteins of different colors into mouse DNA. In our case, we engineered mice so that they would produce a red fluorescent protein from one of the X chromosomes and a green fluorescent protein from the other X chromosome. And so every cell in the body would be either red fluorescent or green fluorescent. Those mice reveal the pattern on a cell-to-cell basis of the activation of either the mother's or the father's X chromosomes. So we can see, for example, within the brain, and the brain to us seems like the most interesting place to look, we could see exactly which cells or which regions expressed which of the two chromosomes. And as you noted, in some of the mice, it was a minority, but perhaps one out of five, there was a clear difference between the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. That seemed to us especially interesting because we know in humans that the left and right sides of the brain are different. The left side of the brain generally has the language area. And one possibility is that some of the difference between the left and the right sides of the brain arise from this sort of X chromosome mosaicism, at least in females. Of course, males would not have that option. But for females, there may be some left-right brain differences that are really due to this special mechanism.
One theory suggested that this genetic versatility, females tend to have more than males, may spare them from some genetic disorders.
Yes, that is certainly true. So the typical genetic disorder that resides on the X chromosome, when the gene for that disorder resides on the X chromosome, the effect of a mutation in that gene is to completely inactivate the corresponding function in a male who carries that because he has no backup copy. In a female, there's the possibility that the roughly 50% of cells that have the normal version of the gene will make up for, or at least partially make up for, the deficiency. A classic example would be hemophilia, a defect in blood clotting. This was most famously carried by Queen Victoria, and she had no problem because 50% of her cells were making quite enough of the blood clotting protein. But among her grandchildren, most famously the young man who would have become the future czar of Russia if the Bolsheviks hadn't intervened, he had only the defective copy, and he had the full-blown disease.
Melissa Wilson-Sayers, you've been looking at the Y chromosome. There's been some thought that that Y chromosome is starting to change, and you've confirmed this to some extent. How is it changing, and how does this manifest itself?
We kind of study two sides of the coin. I agree that the X and Y chromosome are the most interesting parts of the genome. What's fascinating is that we know that the human X and Y chromosome used to be identical, roughly 200 million years ago. And at that point, the Y chromosome acquired a gene called SRY, sex-determining region of the Y, and it became sex chromosomes. And over the last 200 million years, the Y lost about 90% of the genes that it once shared with the X chromosome, and that's led some people to speculate that in the next 5 million years, it might just continue to shrink into nothingness. And what we show is that is very unlikely to happen. So what we did is we compared actually the whole genome, so the whole complement of the non-sex chromosomes, the X chromosome, the Y chromosome, and this little circular piece of DNA called the mitochondria. At the whole genome, we see that across human males, across the globe, on the Y chromosome, variation is much lower than we expect it to be. And that was surprising. And so there's been conflicting hypotheses about that. One of them is that there is variance in male reproductive success. And this is that some men father many children, and some men father few or no children. And if you think about that, then it was explained, if you inherit a Y chromosome, you develop as a male. Well, if there's just very few males passing on their Y chromosomes, then you'll just have lower variation on the Y chromosome because you'll be much more related. What we show is that that's not the whole story. That might be happening a little bit, but that's not sufficient to explain the low Y variation. We need an additional force, which is natural selection, acting to purify out harmful mutations on the Y chromosome to observe the low levels of variation. Why this is fascinating is it means that natural selection is still acting on what is left on the Y chromosome. So even though there's only 27 unique genes, the X has approximately 1,100. Those 27 are very important and are likely to stick around for the foreseeable future.
One of the things I found confusing was that there have already been some mammals that don't have a Y chromosome. And if this is so, which ones and what does that mean really about the Y chromosome and maleness?
Although the Y chromosome occurs in males only, we shouldn't think about it as needing a Y chromosome to be a male. What you actually need are the genes that are on the Y chromosome. And you're right, there are some species, so there's an Okinawa spiny rat where it doesn't have a Y chromosome anymore. But what we think happened is that the genes on the Y chromosome fused to one of the non-sex chromosomes. And now what we have there is a novel, young sex chromosome system. And those, that non-sex pair that now has the sex-determining region, those genes from the Y chromosome, that will become a new sex chromosome pair, and it will start to degrade and go through the same process that our sex chromosomes have gone through. So although we do think that the genes around the Y chromosome are very important, they're likely to stick around for a while, if something were to happen to that chromosome, the genes would still persist somewhere in our genome, and we wouldn't lose males. So there's no need to worry. We're not going to become some Amazon-specific, female-only society.
What a relief.
Yeah. Now, what about people who have XYY chromosomes? What does this mean?
So there are people with a single X chromosome, X-naught. This is Turner syndrome. There are people that are XXY, Klinefelter syndrome. They present as male. There's XYY. You can have a lot of variations. And so this is where there's actually a huge bridge between our work. Generally, you need that SRY, that sex-determining region of the Y, to turn on this transcriptional pathway that will turn on the formation of testes and making sperm. And so if you have that SRY, whether you have two Ys or whether you've even just moved that SRY and some of the related genes to a non-sex chromosome, the male determining pathway will still be turned on. That's interesting when you talk about the differences in the chromosome. So there can be XXX individuals and they still undergo this X inactivation. I'm sure that's kind of an interesting link between these. All of the non-sex chromosomes do inherit one copy from the paternal lineage and one copy from the maternal lineage. So you have two copies of everything. And on the sex chromosomes, it's different. So females have one X from their mother, one from their father. But males have one X from their mother and one Y from their father. And the problem is, whereas all of the non-sex chromosomes have a partner to swap with if there's any mistakes anywhere, the Y chromosome doesn't have a partner. If there are mistakes that accumulate on the Y chromosome, it doesn't have a partner to swap with to get rid of those mistakes. And so if those mistakes are severe enough, if they lead to infertility, if they lead to sperm that don't swim properly or have misshapen heads, then you have to get rid of that entire Y chromosome. And in doing so, you get rid of the harmful mutation, which is a good thing, but you also get rid of all of the neutral variation that's accumulated on that chromosome.
One aspect of the Y that's especially fascinating is that because it's inherited from father to son, to grandson, to great-grandson, and so on, without ever having the opportunity to swap information with another Y chromosome, then it's essentially a pure historical record of what happened with each generation going all the way back to the proverbial Adam. So wonderful example of the way that's been used in anthropological research is, for example, if you look at the exact sequence on the Y chromosome of Jews whose last name is Cohen, Cohen in Hebrew means priest, what you find is that they share the same DNA signature on their Y chromosomes. Why? Because the last name has traditionally gone down in the family from father to son, just the way the Y chromosome has. And initially, the priesthood was also inherited in the same way. That is, the son of a priest became a priest, and so on. And so going back thousands of years, the same Y chromosome has been handed down from father to son among those whose last name is Cohen. And there are many other examples like that.
Melissa Wilson-Sayers?
There was one individual that had our whole genome. And what it really means is that for every part of our genome, for the non-sex chromosome, for the every piece of the X chromosome, for the Y chromosome, and which is inherited through the male lineage, and for the mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited through the female lineage, you can find a most recent common ancestor. But there's no one individual that had the common ancestral sequence of all of those. The time to the most recent common ancestor of the Y chromosome, while it's extremely useful in looking at the population of the world, the person who had the Y chromosome, that is the ancestor of all living Y chromosomes, had non-sex chromosome DNA from thousands of people and shared between thousands of people. And you can think about it in a family. If there is one son, he shares his Y chromosome with his father and with his grandfather, but his non-sex chromosomes came from his father and his mother and his two maternal grandparents, his paternal grandparents. So we're huge composites, and we hold a whole evolutionary history in our genomes.
Jeremy Nathans.
That's a beautiful way to look at it, because each of us is unique many times over. Our genomes are completely different, with the exception of identical twins who have the same genomes. But each of us has a combination of historical records built within our genome that gives us a wonderful uniqueness, and I think that's something to celebrate.
Thank you so much, Jeremy Nathans and Melissa Wilson-Sayers. It's been a great pleasure to have you with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, what is the celebrity industrial complex? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We've long been warned about the power of the military-industrial complex. But is there a celebrity industrial complex? What exactly is it, and how does it affect our lives, our society, and our politics? We have three experts with us. Joshua Gamson is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco and the author of Claims to Fame, Celebrity in Contemporary America. David Marshall is also with us. He's chair of New Media, Communication, and Cultural Studies at Deakin University in Australia. He's the author of Celebrity and Power, Fame in Contemporary Culture, New Media Cultures, and The Celebrity Culture Reader. David Giles is with us. He is a professor of media psychology at the University of Winchester in the UK. He's author of Illusions of Immortality, A Psychology of Fame and Celebrity, and Psychology of the Media. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here with us. David Giles, I'd like to start with you before we go into the impacts of this, what people call the celebrity industrial complex. We should start with what exactly we mean when we say celebrity.
I think the first thing is to draw a distinction between Common or Garden fame and maybe not Common or Garden, but fame itself and celebrity. Which is something I've always been quite keen to make distinct, because the process by which one becomes famous, I think we can trace throughout history, we can also trace at different levels in society. So it's possible to become famous, in a sense, within a bounded community, like a school, for example. There's always one student who is, or several students, who are more famous than the other students. And the sense in which one can become famous for doing certain things, or by accident, or because they occupy a particular position in society, like a president or some sort of other monarchy or something like that. But celebrity itself seems to me to be something that's very much bound up with media. And although we can, in a McLuhanish sense, we can always identify a medium that spreads people's well-knownness and makes people famous under any conditions, I think the mass media intrinsically linked with celebrity. So it's really something that's very much a 20th century phenomenon.
So you would say it hasn't always been with us in terms of, I mean, we used to have monarchies and they were famous.
Well, they were famous, but they weren't celebrities in quite the same way as someone whose fame has been spread by mass media. And I think that's the distinction I would make, in the sense that the modern-day celebrity is someone who just very visible in the media, rather than necessarily someone who does anything particular, who's talked about for his or her achievements or deeds. Because of that, celebrities just multiplied to a kind of dizzying extent, whereby we have so many celebrities, we can't possibly know them all, and they're becoming harder and harder to function as common knowledge between people.
This is David Marshall. David's pretty accurate. Got to get used to two Davids here. What I would add to that is what I always say is the defining feature of what celebrity is, which is that we gain knowledge about actually maybe what they're not famous for. And the word I use is that they move into this extra textual area, which means that it's not necessarily what they've done. It's what they're doing maybe in their personal lives or in some other aspect. We have a lot of activism going on with celebrities, and that would be an example of them using, in a sense, their renown and moving it into some other realm. We've become increasingly comfortable with that over the last century, really. I think David also characterizes it as fairly primarily media-centric, meaning that it emerged somehow out of the media. And quite a few people talk about that. Historically, there's something that has changed roughly from about the 18th century to now, which is that we begin to look at people differently. It may be that it's parasocial, which means that we're not as connected as we think we are to the group of people that we know. And it also has qualities that it isn't attached necessarily to the way that power was constructed in the past. So that's why monarchies are really interesting to look at, because they really identify a transformation from authentic power to ceremonial power. And they become, in a way, a pathway to understand the emergence of celebrity. If you look at English monarchy, in a way, in the 19th century, or as it emerges in the 20th century, and you look at it in the late 20th century, and you see how various royal houses, maybe not the Saudi one, embody a celebrity relationship to their nation and to culture more widely, and have less to do with other kinds of embodiment.
In other words, they don't have the kind of governance power that they did at one point, but they have power as a result of all the privilege that's bestowed upon them by being famous.
Yes, but it's translated, and this is the media element, it's translated into something beyond that, that becomes an organization, an economic organization, meaning that we sell magazines or online sites through this other element that we want to know a little bit about their past, a kind of pathway to the truthfulness of a being, a very famous being. And we get caught up in trying to work out what that is. And so as much as we produce, you know, fictional dramas, serializations of all sorts of things, films, we also produce an amazing sort of construction of narrative of that this is somehow closer to the truth of this being that we see on screen or that we watch in some other environment, because we get into almost their intimate and home life. So a lot of what's happened in the last 200 years is directly via celebrity related to democracy. It's kind of a translation of democracy in a really bizarre and quite twisted way. It's a celebration of individuality, but it's a celebration of individuality that doesn't have the sense of being already ascribed that power before.
It's funny you would say that about the democratic element. As I looked at it, I thought it's almost contradictory to democracy because it contradicts the idea of every man and every woman being equal.
Yeah, and that's the bizarre sort of relationship to it. It's very much a kind of, another way of thinking of it is very connected to a kind of consumer capitalism relationship to democracy, which is that it's highly individualized, but it also privileges the idea that any individual can achieve, even if it's mythic, can achieve the notion of being significant. And that's the democratic dimension of it, that there's no difference between my vote and your vote. And also there's no difference between that a celebrity could come from Indiana as much as, you know, Bangalore, India. You know, you can't make the distinction that one celebrity or a celebrity can only emerge from some other form of cultural elite. So that's the democratic element. It is mythic. It's the Hollywood myth. It's the American myth, but it's played out into a very public version of the expression of individuality.
Joshua Gamson, you've also looked at how this culture and fame and celebrity are actually created. What is this celebrity creation?
I wanted to first add in or to pull out a piece of what people are talking about so far, which is the definitional piece. To me, when I'm sort of boiling down what is a celebrity or what is the phenomenon of celebrity in contemporary times, it has to do with the capacity to attract attention, that's the kind of currency that's being circulated. And that is very much part of you know, the reason we're talking about it as a media phenomenon is that that capacity to attract attention has monetary value within an industry that uses that. So, you know, if I think about people that we're paying attention to now and look at how they're attention-getting capacity is being used. We're just talking about, for the most part, the selling of products. And that's the piece that I always focus on.
So that's really this aspect of the celebrity industrial complex.
Yeah. And if you're talking about the definition of celebrity, what is it? Then if it's the capacity to attract attention, then it's the industry that gives that attention value, or that makes money from it and makes it gives it financial value.
It sounds like you're saying it's just being turned into another commodity.
I think what's also interesting about it, and Josh identifies that idea of the industrial and the commodity element of it, but it's also that it isn't that as well. It's an emotional relationship that is translatable in terms of cultural value. And I guess that's why I brought up, there's been a lot of writing, but a lot of activity of, say, Angelina Jolie, you could go on and on with the different types of celebrities that have tried to translate that kind of cultural power into something else. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's good, that it's into some notion of activism, but it does mean that it translates sometimes. To use a kind of sociological definition, it moves between cultural fields. So it's possible that you could have an Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's possible that you could have a Bill Bradley as a basketball player. It's possible that you could have someone who emerges somewhere else and is able to take that kind of cultural economic value, and very much an attention economy captures that, and move it somewhere else. It moves from the commodity itself into something else. As much as it sells the original commodity of the film, it actually becomes a kind of cultural commodity in and of itself that can be moved, or value in and of itself that can be moved to other realms of society.
This is Josh again. I completely agree with that. And I guess what I'm saying is I think of it as a form of capital. It can be translated into, just like any form of capital or currency, it can be cashed in or translated into another form of capital. So it can become a form of social capital in terms of the networks into which you're, valuable networks in which you're located. It can be a form of political capital. I agree that it's translatable. I mean, under certain conditions, you know, we see that happening all the time.
One of the earlier ones being Barnum, who did create the circus, and how he created celebrity was fascinating. What's the similarity or difference for what Barnum did?
Clearly, there are attempts to build this form of attention-getting capital. And it also is clear that it doesn't always work. But then a whole industry has clearly been built up around the attempt to put attention-getting into a person, so that that person can then be placed in different environments and attract an audience, which can then be sold, so to turn that person into some form of a commodity. The Barnum example is people who are trying to get it to create manufactured events in which they're telling a story about a person which is or isn't true in order to generate interest in that person. So it's the sort of Carnival Barker approach to things. And we still see that now. If I ask my students, if I wanted to be famous, what should I do? They have lots of ideas about the ways that I could be transformed from me, this individual person, into a celebrity who people are interested in. And they would involve taking some piece of me that actually exists and exploding it, creating a whole entire narrative around it, or inventing from whole cloth some other version of me, and then getting sponsorship behind it, getting a machine behind it. So that's all in place, and it's been in place for a long time. Once I'm created, once my life story is told in an interesting enough way, I can then be placed in other venues as a commodity, used to sell magazines, used to sell something else. That's the attempted process, but the structures of that creative process change a lot, and they've changed recently, and we're seeing new forms of celebrity for that reason.
Let's turn to the psychology element. And David Giles, let's bring you back here. You've talked about both on the celebrity side and also on the fan side what this interaction is. How would you explain this?
To conclude with what Josh was saying about the commodity aspect of celebrity and how that's what I was trying to explain by using the animals as an example. And kind of everything that Josh and David have been saying could be applied to the animals in the paper I wrote recently, such as Knut the polar bear, as in terms of the this idea about the capacity to attract attention and being commodified, and kind of embodying the emotional aspect, emotional connection with the audience as well. In response to your question, I mean, the interesting thing about celebrity as in relation to its audience is that this seems to be something which we can trace back through all societies throughout history, which is in the sense of having people that we like to talk about and speculate about and gossip about. And I suppose, again, using a very everyday example of that, the way in which people in a company or a workplace will talk about their boss, and usually their boss is the subject of all sorts of speculation and intense curiosity, because they live a little bit apart from the workforce, and they have to kind of maintain this critical distance from them. And in a sense, celebrity is a little bit like that, in that these people who are well-known and are working within what appears to be this sacred space attract this intense curiosity on behalf of the audience or the general public, who obviously want to know more about what they get up to, especially when they're not performing their very visible role as a celebrity, so when they're off stage in their private life. That's very much the kind of psychological appeal of celebrity. And obviously there is this emotional investment that David was talking about that that constitutes fandom. But I don't think you have to be a fan of a celebrity to be extremely curious and interested in them. I think we're often just as interested in people who we aren't at all fans of, who we don't even like. One of the phenomena associated with reality TV and other contemporary modes of celebrity is that very often we're interested in people actually because we don't particularly like them, but we're still necessarily curious about what they get up to when they're not performing on screen or on stage or whatever.
This is Josh. I think that's one of several kinds of identifiable relationships between people who pay attention to celebrities and the people that they're paying attention to, is the gossip that has been around forever, that kind of curiosity about other people's lives. But with celebrities, unlike with your boss, there's no risk that it's ever going to get back to Tom Cruise that I'm gossiping about his sexuality, and there's not going to be any consequence to that activity. I think that turns out to be a kind of productive of gossip that is more enjoyable, and I think for most people, to gossip when there's not a concern about consequences. So celebrities, because they're not particularly consequential in people's lives, maybe an individual fan relationship is a little bit different, but that sort of generalized talk about people in the public eye, they're inconsequential in most people's lives, and that makes them really good for the kind of conversations that take place through gossip, which tend to be about collective judgments about the morality of people's behaviors, whether somebody is really what they say they are, those kinds of things.
So there are different aspects to what generates this, it sounds like you're saying. One is perhaps what David Giles has written about a bit, which is an actual charisma. But some of it is, this was in Josh's work, about really manipulating attention and manipulating belief. Another piece is just about position. Somebody is the boss, or somebody is put on television. Somebody happens to be the sister of a young woman who married a prince and is pretty.
David Giles, you're quite right. There's different ways of becoming famous. So just as one can become famous because one is just happens to occupy that status of boss or president or whatever, or because you've done something exceptional, if you like, you're a sports performer and you've won some competition, or if you are just someone who is particularly good looking. And in each case, the experiences of celebrity will be slightly different. And so, yes, the pathways to fame or ultimately to celebrity are different. And so there are these diverse experiences across the sector.
David Marshall here. Also, it's important to see this spectrum in terms of that larger dimension of celebrity and what some writers are using the term kind of micro-celebrity. A book by Alice Marwick about Silicon Valley gets very close to saying how that whole tech scene produced a relationship of celebrity in terms of the technological entrepreneur, which is not necessarily what they did as entrepreneurs, but how they presented themselves in that online community in terms of where they were, who they were with, the structure and the relationships that they produced by it, led on to another production of a kind of gossip around them. In some ways, that kind of gossip is between what Josh was describing as, you know, the boss kind of stuff, because this is clearly a community of several hundred thousand potential workers or people who want to rise in a particular area and individuals within that. So it's kind of almost not the same as the structure of this highly mediatized celebrity. But what I think has happened over more or less the last 20 or 30 years is that celebrity culture has actually been, I wouldn't call it democratized, but has been played out in a lot of environments, including fan environments. People who are closer to the star are actually given an aura of celebrity because they have some insight into what's happening with a particular star within a fan community. So one of the things that I've been looking at most recently is the translation of a celebrity culture into a wider culture, mainly through online dimensions. And through that, it becomes something that is not just us watching in a fan-like way, but actually becomes a consciousness of how influence is constructed much more than it ever has in the past. So it's a translation that we are, in a sense, almost by online culture, mediatized, maybe not at the same level as we've seen in the highly mediated television, radio, film world, but still operating at the level of Facebook worlds and the crossover between those. To give you an example of that, Scott Willis, Demi Moore's and Bruce Willis's daughter, is 22 years old and has gone on this crusade of making breasts visible. And Instagram blocked it, and Twitter allowed the images to sort of come from Scott Willis. Now, she's nowhere near a major celebrity, but her action produced a kind of flurry of all sorts of activities by making a kind of statement. So she emerges from a status of meta-celebrity into something else, but also nowhere near anything that you would say that millions are watching.
It seems like that's the kind of celebrity that's developed by challenging a norm.
That's true. That's out there a lot, whether it was Lenny Bruce or in comedy, or whether it's Evel Knievel going over Snake River Canyon. A sad celebrity in some ways.
I imagine in order to have this culture where we have celebrities and then we have everybody else, you have to have two other aspects. One is a participant who is willing to be the celebrity, or in the case of the animals, probably don't even realize they're the celebrities. Then the other aspect is, what does this kind of mean for society, for politics, for democracy, for these kinds of other ideals that we talk about? David Giles, let's go back to you for a moment. You're our psychologist. You've studied the psychology on both sides of this, including the celebrities themselves and the kind of almost addictive nature there is to being very famous.
Well, it's certainly addictive in the sense that it's a life-changing experience to become a celebrity, undoubtedly the case for anyone who's experienced it. But of course, one of the things that comes with celebrity is the need to maintain it. It's like buying a new car or a pet or something that you obviously have to keep it going. And that is sometimes extremely difficult if your celebrity is founded on something that is not particularly easy to recreate. I mean, we've talked before about some of the things that people become famous for, such as bucking a trend or acting against the norm. So we had this example of Scott Willis that David mentioned. Now, okay, making breasts visible might be a good means of keeping your celebrity status going for a short while, but people will become bored with your breasts, I imagine, after a little bit. And at that
speak point, for yourself, David.
Well, I've never seen Scott Willis's breasts, so I can't possibly judge that one. But the problem is, whatever it is that makes you famous in the first place doesn't always endure. And obviously, if you've done something, if you're a sports performer, this is an example of meritocratic fame, because in a sense, a sports performer is invariably only as good as their performances on the field, unless they are able to, as we mentioned before, we talked about different fields that you can move into. And I suppose one of the things that celebrities are often encouraged to do is to seek other fields to move into. But your success in those other fields is often very difficult to guarantee, unless you really are multi-talented or you have such a high level of celebrity that you can't possibly fail. So what we find is that sometimes people who get this very instantaneous burst of celebrity that puts them in the public eye for a short period, for example, appearing in a reality TV show, often find that that very intense experience vanishes very quickly afterwards. This can be extremely difficult to cope with, because if you're seeking celebrity, if you're seeking fame and recognition, then it's serving an important psychological function for you. But if you can't maintain it, if you lose it, then it's quite a traumatic experience to have to cope with. That is a very difficult thing for a lot of people. And even people who are very talented and have built a really good bedrock for their continuing celebrity can struggle once they perhaps have some difficulties in their personal life that make it harder to function as a celebrity, and they succumb to various temptations, drugs, alcohol and so on. They mess around with their relationships. And those people also, even if they don't actually lack the talent to keep their celebrity going, if their personal life suffers as a result, then sometimes that can also be an added difficulty to have to deal with. And we have a good example in Britain of a famous footballer, Paul Gascoigne. I don't know how well known he might be stateside, but he was one of the most famous people in Britain in 1990, in the early 90s. But he's now really quite a sad figure because he became addicted to alcohol. He suffered various mental health problems. And now the only time he's in the media is when he's being checked into another secure unit for therapy. So this is a guy who was very talented, but despite his attempts to move into another field, he tried a bit of football management, a bit of coaching, but it didn't work because of his ongoing personal problems. And yes, it is a very fragile, celebrity is a very fragile thing to have to try and cope with in the long run.
One of your interviewees in your piece said he'd been addicted to every substance known to man, and the most addicting was fame. So when you lose that, it does seem like maybe he would have to fill it with something else.
Certainly if you sort it out in the first place to fulfill a need. But of course, one of the things about addictions is that, well, very often the word addiction is used in a metaphorical sense, in that we believe we can't live without it. And I think one of the things that can perhaps ease the passage for many celebrities is people who can keep them grounded in some way. And I think one of the ways they can do that is to develop a much more realistic understanding of how media work and how fragile their own celebrity is right from the word go. And I think one of the problems is it's very hard for people to disassociate the media coverage from their own personal qualities and believe that they're famous because of who they are, rather than actually because, as we've been saying earlier, they produce something that's temporarily, commercially desirable.
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the celebrity industrial complex and its effect on society. Then let's take this into the broader context of what all this means really for society. It's been a few years now, but we had that whole Occupy movement railing against the 1%. And many of the people who are enduring celebrities are, of course, part of the so-called 1%. It still creates a sort of privileged class in everybody else. Joshua Gamson, I'm going to bring you in because you did a lot of citing of Neil Postman's work dealing with amusing ourselves to death. What are the implications of all this?
The thing that you're saying about the 1% may be a slightly separate thing. I mean, it's just a question of what is the impact of having elites of any kind that are super privileged, and this is one element of that, a sort of cultural and economic elite without political power. That's one set of questions, and then there's the question about does this phenomenon do damage society-wide, and we've already talked about some of the potential damage of having and losing celebrity as a famous person. But, you know, there's also a lot of complaint about the impact of celebrity culture on the society in general, sort of ways in which it's pathological for the society. So, for instance, that what you basically have is a system in which people are distracted by trivial stories of people who don't matter from the things that do matter more deeply in a society, inequality, you know, bigger life questions and so on. That's one possibility, and I think there is a lot of that going on, but it's not even the only pitch from the industry that we should be admiring of these people and interested in them and even identified with them. The industry doesn't require a lot of reverence for the people that are supposedly above us in this celebrity stratosphere. It operates perfectly well with people gossiping about people they don't care about or don't like or don't identify with. So to me, the starting point is always, what are people doing with this cultural material? And some people are doing pathological things with it. They are distracting themselves from things that, if they weren't distracted by celebrities, they would be focused on deeper problems. They are identifying with people who are providing bad or superficial role models. So, you know, there is some of that. I worry about it with my kids. You know, my daughter, do I want her to be relating to celebrity culture in such a, as though it's this real thing in her life and she should be looking up to see what J-Lo is doing and so on? That's all the one side of it. On the other side of it, people are having a lot of other kinds of conversations and doing a lot of other kinds of activities that don't seem particularly pathological to me and actually seem useful for the society. One of the things that people do a lot when they're talking about celebrities is talk about the difference between the image and what might be behind that image. So even at the level, at the very common and superficial level of, you know, just asking if you've met somebody, what are they really like, or commenting that they're shorter, which they always seem to be, shorter in person, that kind of thing, is still about distinguishing between an image that you know is being manufactured for your consumption and what might be behind that. That kind of conversation in a society like ours, where we are being approached pretty constantly, at least through media, with a pitch, with, like, you know, this is a person you should vote for, this is a person you should buy, and so on and so forth, there's a lot of BS to contend with. And so I think it's a pretty productive thing for people to be, have an opportunity to constantly practice detecting the BS that's around them.
David Marshall.
It's complicated, and I would agree with all the pathologies that are there that can happen, that can distract people. But I think the larger dimension is probably related back to Josh's notion of how it transforms a culture in terms of value. In other words, that we see this pattern of attention, this pattern of trying to produce influence as being ultimately more important than some of the other things that we do, more important than what David Giles talked about in terms of fame can come from doing something significant. And that we, as a culture, we move to something about attention itself being ultimately more valuable than some other activities. So the danger with Josh's daughter is to also get confused about what is valuable in their own lives. So, you know, there have been lots of surveys and lots of surveys of young people where it's pointed out where they see becoming famous as being valuable in and of itself. In these surveys, they can't really say what it is that they are famous for, but the idea of fame itself becomes valuable, or the idea of a celebrity status becomes valuable. So that's one sort of level, a cultural level of change that I'm saying is also occurring and being manifest, in a sense, in online culture and the way it attracts attention. That attracting of attention is actually fed back into the commodity system because our online culture makes us expose ourselves. In the same way as celebrity culture is a lot about exposure, we now have generalized that in a sense of a large, large portion of our lives being exposed. So I think that's a consequence of the power of celebrity culture.
Even in the sense of the meritocratic areas, say you're a great athlete, for example, I think that was the one, David Giles, you mentioned. But even in these ideas of meritocracy, where somebody's just good at what they do, we've celebritized certain fields, like it's more important to be a great football player than it is to be a great scientist.
That is true, that we have presented that hierarchy, which doesn't make any sense. The reward to play football seems out of proportion, other than that we know that the television rights or other rights that go to the actual team that the football star is attached to makes it economically sensible that the person who attracts that attention should get a fairly large proportion of what comes in. At the same time, I suppose that may or may not be the case. What I would say is that this generalization is actually shaping and shifting more professions than we really imagine. that we think it's part of entertainment culture, but it's definitely part of political culture in terms of that notion of attention. But it's probable, and this is the area that I'm looking at now, that we're also constructing this notion of attention in medicine, in law, in probably the areas that you're talking about in terms of science. And we see it very visibly. I think David and Josh would agree with me that there is a bit of that, quite a bit of that, even in the academic sphere about how attention is attracted to certain academics in a certain way.
You can't see me nodding, but I'm nodding.
Is driven by that same notion of what a certain author that studies celebrity calls residual value, that extra value that is beyond the activity itself. Now, I wanted to say one other thing, which is a little bit different than that, a little bit of a change in certain things that identifies a larger cultural value with celebrity. When I wrote my first book on this, I talked about that there was something about celebrity culture that actually attached to other powerful political dimensions. And the key one is, and Josh has got close to it, is that it identifies an opening up of the personal is political. And if everyone knows that phrase, it definitely comes from women's liberation, second-generation feminism. And there's something about what celebrity identifies, which is that it thinks of the personal, the intimate, as a pathway to a better world, a better culture. Because, as Josh was describing, it gets us to take apart image and look at it really closely. The interesting thing is I've been recently drawn to Hannah Arendt's work about what she imagined as public and private, and lamented, in a sense, that we had allowed too much, even though she wasn't writing about it, we've allowed too much of the private to enter our public discourse. So where Josh was describing how we might get distracted by all this other stuff, celebrity Rihanna, as opposed to looking at the politics of what's happening in our backyards, and, you know, the 1% controlling too much of, you know, politics and economy, is that we are moving into a world where we've allowed the intimate to maybe have too much of a say in our public discourse. And that's where celebrity culture is really interesting. Have we gone too far in this idea that it's a revelation that helps us in a political sense, in a cultural sense? Have we gone too far in seeing that this public discourse of intimacy, whether it's reality television, whether it's and its versions of celebrity, is going too far in distracting? And so I think what's emerging is a weird notion that because of our wider awareness across, because of, in some ways, online culture, we're aware of this attention economy, that things are beginning to shift again, that we're also becoming aware of the lines of public and private way more than we have in past decades and past centuries.
Joshua Gamson.
So I really like what David Marshall is saying. I just think some of the disturbing aspects of what's been happening, he put his finger on, the kind of shrinking of private life, the constant encouragement to expose, and the value shift where attention itself becomes the goal, and I've seen that a lot. What I wanted to add is that, and I think, David, this is maybe what you were saying towards the end of your comments, is that there's a certain insight in the fact that people are valuing attention. Like when my daughter says, and she's 8, when she says, you know, well, I want to be famous because then we'll have a lot of money and this is what we can do with it. She's, you know, in a very rudimentary 8-year-old way, recognizing the structure that's in front of her, that attention itself is valuable in a marketplace. So there's a correct seeing of the structure, even at that level, that's happening, which makes it even more disturbing to me, because this is structural. You are getting rewarded for the exposure of intimate life, and in fact, even, you know, all of the online exposure of self that's so constant, in addition to reality TV, just the constant online on Vine, the kinds of videos that people are creating, the showing of your, you know, of body parts on Snapchat, and all of that kind of exposure, that's the way in to this attention economy. That's the way in without having a publicist. And it works. For a lot of people, it works. So it's very hard to imagine how you get out of that cycle. And I guess I'm kind of waiting for the backlash. I actually do think it's coming, but, you know, we'll see. I'm a terrible prognosticator. But the backlash to the sense that what we should be pursuing is attention, and the way of getting that attention should be the exposure of our intimate selves and our intimate lives constantly, and that there's so little room left for people to be, how do I put it, alone and unwatched.
David Giles.
I think Josh has hit the nail on the head there in the sense of visibility. And interesting is to see if there would be a backlash, but my feeling is that maybe it wouldn't be so much a backlash as sort of gradual dissolution of celebrity, in the sense that we've entered a potential new era for fame. Talked at the beginning of the discussion about how we agreed that we could identify celebrity as sort of mass media phenomenon that gradually emerged with the spread of media from newspapers onto Hollywood, onto TV, and then onto the internet. But of course, what we've got now is this shrinking on one level and expansion on the other, which is that our young people in particular are becoming socialized into a world in which they are themselves part of the same media. They're no longer just consumers, and they're producing themselves as these micro-celebrities. I think David mentioned earlier this concept of micro-celebrity, so that now almost all of my students will have their profile on Facebook or possibly on Twitter as well, with hundreds of so-called friends who've attached themselves to them, and they're living out a very visible existence in terms of the number of pictures and movies and so on that they've uploaded. I mean, it's always possible that eventually this might be enough to be a micro-celebrity. That's more, I mentioned before, that you've just got this incredible multiplication of celebrities now where there are so many it's almost impossible to keep up. And maybe we'll reach a saturation point at some stage where we eventually are content just to be a celebrity within our own social media circle, as it were, because that's enough attention and that's enough recognition. I don't know when that point would come, but you know, it's just another form of celebrity, perhaps, that could even supersede the current one.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Joshua Gamson is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco and the author of Claims to Fame, Celebrity in Contemporary America. David Marshall is chair of New Media, Communication, and Cultural Studies at Deakin University in Australia. He's the author of Celebrity and Power, Fame in Contemporary Culture, New Media Cultures, and The Celebrity Culture Reader. David Giles is a professor of media psychology at the University of Winchester in the UK. He's author of Illusions of Immortality, A Psychology of Fame and Celebrity, and Psychology of the Media. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.